RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
David Thunder is an Irish philosopher and professor of political science at the University of Navarra in Spain. His work focuses on political philosophy, democracy, and the impact of digital technologies on society. He's especially interested in issues connected with the culture and institutions of a free and open society. We have chatted with David twice already last year, I think back in November, and before that, September 2023. And he joins us again. David, it's great to have you back.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Okay, the walls are closing in, David, it seems.
Yes, it seems that the general tendency to restrict speech has been intensified in the last couple of weeks, in the last several weeks, in Europe and the United Kingdom, and also in Ireland. So I'd say Europe in general is a hotspot for free speech restrictions at the moment.
Where to start? Let's start with the latest, UK. I mean, you're not in the UK, but you're not that far away, and I'm sure you've been observing it very closely. I'm wondering if you kind of predicted what you've seen would happen based on what you've been writing about and thinking about, you know, for quite some years now. Is it the playbook in operation?
Well, I would say that it's true that during the pandemic, I warned that public emergencies would be abused by governments to introduce additional restrictions and to curtail civil liberties. And I did lay out what the playbook was: declare an emergency, say that these are exceptional powers you need to use in order to restore some form of public order or defend public health or whatever it might be, and suspend civil liberties. And that kind of playbook is indeed playing out. If you look at the riots in the United Kingdom, which basically were sparked by a horrendous murder by an adolescent who was basically the son of Rwandan parents, was not a Muslim. It was reported to be a Christian family from Rwanda. But it was what a lot of people thought that, let's say there were rumors going around that it was a Muslim refugee, and that was not accurate because he was born in the United Kingdom. But be that as it may, the ensuing riots, because basically, you know, a number of children were murdered in cold blood by a 17-year-old, you know, a boy, by a young boy, by an adolescent. And so that kind of hit a nerve in the United Kingdom because of the connection with Rwanda. And basically, there were a lot of protests, anti-immigration protests. These protests became violent in certain instances, and it kind of spread across different cities. And the UK government basically started to say that it was going to clamp down on social media and on speech surrounding these protests. And so it was putting out a lot of publicity about the fact that it was scouring the internet in search of incendiary speech or speech that might incite violence or hatred. They did, in fact, prosecute a number of individuals, and they promised to prosecute more over hateful content, over, you know, content that they believed would lead to hate and violence. And I think this kind of, I would say, this whole debate, in order to understand it properly, you have to distinguish between hard cases in which there may be violent intentions, and, let's say, the general precedent. So I'll just give you an example. Say someone says, you know, I'm sick of immigrants taking our jobs. Somebody says something like that. That's a contribution towards public discourse. Now, it might seem like a generalization. You might not agree with it. It might seem a bit crude. It might need to be nuanced. But the argument that that kind of speech could be, you know, lead to hate and violence If we make that kind of argument, then almost any provocative, forceful speech could lead to hate or violence. It's a speculative move to say this speech could produce violence and hatred. That's very, very different to the kind of speech, for example, if I were to say, you have to go to so-and-so's house and kill him, right? That is a direct incitement to violence. Big difference. And that line between direct incitement to violence and incitement to hate or to emotional upset is being blurred and becoming very ambiguous. And so by blurring that line, they're able to make more prosecutions and they're able to apply the law to people who are engaging in legitimate public discourse. And that's what's happening across Europe. It's happening in the United Kingdom. In Ireland, it's there's an intention to do that. They haven't ramped it up quite as much as the UK. But in Ireland, you see the same kind of thing happening with the government constantly going on about how Twitter X is a dangerous platform. We have to sort of, you know, we have to control it more. And then with the anti-immigration riots and the burnings of some of the immigration centres in Ireland, there's also this call to restrict social media content surrounding immigration.
Which is an interesting thing, David. Sorry to interrupt, but this is an interesting thing because there does seem to be a very distinct correlation. And Simon Elmer has been on this program and he's run the numbers. There is a correlation between the more recent increase in immigration and crime. You know, it's there does seem to be something real there. So to criticize those policies would be a natural outcome of people's, which has now been shown through statistics. Now, more data analysis probably needs to be done, but the lines on the graph track. So people are being asked to deny a reality, really, aren't they?
Well, I haven't really studied closely the correlation between immigration and crime. However, I would say that the hypothesis that immigration could contribute towards crime, certain kinds of immigration, especially illegal immigration, is not ridiculous. It's not absurd. And it's a hypothesis that deserves to be studied. So even if someone doesn't accept off the bat that immigration drives crime, the fact is that kind of argument, we have a right to have that argument in the public sphere and to put that hypothesis to the test. What is not acceptable is to say, because I don't like the kind of argument you're making, because I happen to disagree with it, therefore I'm going to shut you down and stop you from making the argument. We need to have the argument, and if someone is so confident that immigration has nothing to do with crime, then let's have the argument to the open and let's bring out the evidence and put it to the test. That's what I would call for, even though I haven't. I'm very conservative about making statements, and so I'm sure there could be an argument made for that case, a case made for that. But my main argument right now is simply that we need a free public sphere in which people can actually make the arguments that they want to make. And my second argument is that you cannot prosecute people based on the idea that they're inciting hatred. That is a travesty of law, and that is a Pandora's box. It opens up the possibility of a prosecutor using the concept of hate speech to basically prosecute anyone who engages in polemical or controversial speech that he doesn't like the look of or the sound of. That is what you're opening up. Like just as an example, say someone says, I don't agree with transgender operations for minors, right? Say someone says that. And they say, furthermore, I think it's criminal, if someone says it's criminal to subject a minor to a transgender operation to try to give them hormonal therapy that's irreversible. Okay, someone might say, you are stoking up hatred against trans people, right? Trans individuals. And what's the counter argument to that? Is it possible that someone might feel hatred towards trans individuals after I make that argument? Yes, it's possible that someone hears that argument and feels hatred in their heart. But this is what happens in a democratic society. You have an open discourse, a free public sphere. People say what they want to say. They make their argument. And emotions are sparked. And some people feel hatred. Some people feel love. Some people feel envy. Some people feel resentment. That's how public discourse works. Do we want to shut that down?
Well, you imagine a world without it. You've posted on one of your Substacks recently the letter sent by Thierry Breton, member of the EU Commission, to Dear Mr. Lusk. And it's quite a, well, I'd call it finger wagging at Elon Musk at a minimum, but quite threatening if you read the whole thing. Not only that, it's full of subjective comments and views on what constitutes hate speech. It's a very loose term, discourse that is kind of bad for the society. I don't know how he came to those views, but it makes you wonder if these politicians, representatives of the people, actually really believe this, you know, that they really believe that what they're doing is a good thing here, or it's part of something else. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that some politicians are useful idiots in the sense that they don't really know much of what's going on and they just receive orders and they follow whatever they're told because they don't want to lose the party whip. They don't want to fall into, discredit. They want to fall out of favor. They don't want to fall out of favor with party bosses or whatever. I'm sure there are quite a few politicians in that category. But I think if you're someone like Thierry Breton, which is fairly high up the chain, then I don't believe that Thierry Breton thinks that European citizens need to be protected against an interview with Donald Trump. I don't believe for a second that he thinks we need protection from that interview. I think he's using his position to basically promote the Digital Services Act and to promote increasing restrictions on public speech. And he's taking advantage of this upcoming interview. That's what he was doing, the interview with Musk, between Musk and Trump, to somehow, stoke fear around Musk and around Twitter X, and to try to legitimate or rationalize his intentions to censor Twitter X. Using the Digital Services Act. Now, some people might say, well, Thierry got a little bit out of hand. He just exaggerated a little bit and he lost his cool. The commission distanced itself from his comments and said they hadn't authorized those comments. They were reporting the Financial Times to be distancing themselves from Thierry and saying, that's Thierry. He's a little bit, sometimes he doesn't behave.
Yeah,
he's a bit of a hothead or whatever. And that's a public relations exercise, which is understandable because it was embarrassing, frankly, for him to call for the censorship of an interview with a presidential candidate. However, it should be pointed out that the Digital Services Act already includes terms like threats to civic discourse, whatever that is, threats to, the other thing is disinformation, which is in the eye of the beholder, as we've seen during the pandemic. With lots of things like vaccine harms being censored in the name of combating disinformation, hate speech, which is also in the eye of the beholder. These are things that are embedded within the Digital Services Act, and the Commission, the European Commission, can go to Twitter X and they can audit Twitter X and other social media companies, and they can actually demand from those companies that they take they have a due diligence obligation to mitigate systemic risks, and these risks include threats to civic discourse, disinformation, hate speech, even inclusiveness. Threats to inclusiveness. Whatever that means. Equity. Yeah, whatever that means.
Yeah.
So, or justice, inclusive, equity, these sorts of words that they use, civic discourse, are really the recipe for a tyrant or for a kind of dystopian, you know, despotism or oligarchy, where you could just go in and use these airy-fairy terms like civic discourse. You're a threat to civic discourse. How do you even counter that kind of allegation? It's absolutely unfalsifiable. It's unfalsifiable because I don't know what they mean by I'm a threat to civic discourse. Presumably it means I'm saying things they don't like and that they think could be disruptive. So
I'm also thinking of what's been happening in Ireland, and we've had Ivor Cummins on too talking about this. So we kind of knew what was going on there. But this incitement to violence or hatred and hate offences bill, it's a 2022 bill. Okay, it does those similar things, but also gives police power to enter your home, to access your devices, and offer up prison sentences. This is just blows away the concept of any sort of autonomy or freedom. You just walk in and do that into your most private possessions. It's kind of insane. Again, who thinks they can get away with selling that? Are they selling it? I mean, are people buying this at all?
Well, let's see. It did pass initially the chamber of the parliament by a pretty overwhelming majority, and it included the right to enter someone's house on a suspicion that they might be might have the intention of publishing that there's a probability that they would publish material that could incite
hatred. The
president
stopped it, didn't he? Or he didn't sign it off? Is that what happened?
No, that's not what happened. It just stalled because in the Senate there was a lot of debate about it, and the government just, I think, became nervous because they started to see that there was a bit of a backlash against it, and they just kept kind of putting it off, putting it on the long, you know, just saying, okay, we'll review it in the next few months, and they ended up just shelving it kind of indefinitely because they saw that it was becoming quite polemical and that there were high-profile senators speaking out against it. So I think what's going on now is that, well, what's happened now is that the government has said that they still intend to pass this Hate Offences Act, at least in some form. So they seem quite determined to pass it, even though it's quite an unpopular law. So I'm not sure. I think they'll keep pushing to try to pass it. And I guess their determination to pass illiberal, regressive legislation that will dismantle people's civil rights is quite impressive to me. Because you would think that if they saw that the wind is blowing the other way, that this is unpopular, that there might be a backlash publicly against it, that they would just back away from it and leave it alone. But the fact that they're determined to do it, even though they see it's unpopular, tells me that there's a weird commitment to do this over and above political, the pragmatic considerations.
That was my earlier question. What drives this? Where's the push coming from?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, there is a legal obligation upon all member states, European member states, to criminalize hate speech that comes from the European Union. But it doesn't specify that you have to be really aggressive. In Ireland, we already have a law that criminalizes hate speech. So why would we need to be more aggressive about it? I mean, one theory is that there are lobby groups that are very close to the government and are basically pushing this legislation very strongly behind the scenes. And we do have evidence that there are lobby groups who are unrepresentative, who don't represent the public opinion in any way, shape or form, but are having a great influence. And so we had a referendum on the family recently on immigration that was completely decimated, you know, by, you know, over 60%, 65% or 67%, I think. And the government was pushing that on the doorsteps. And so that was being advocated by lobby groups, so let's say progressive lobby groups, that's what they would call themselves. But it turns out that they didn't represent public opinion at all. But the government allows itself to be led by lobby groups that are not representative of public opinion. Obviously, that's not the full story. I mean, I presume could be other interests, like financial interests in the middle of all of this, and foundations. And I'm not sure, but what is very clear is that the normal democratic process whereby politicians feel the pressure of public opinion and respond to that is being disrupted in the case of hate speech legislation.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're coming up against the time. Is there an inevitable end game in this, do you think, David? I mean, that's what everyone has on their mind. Where does this end up? Does it end up in some kind of ultimate pushback from, the common person pushing back on this? Does it end up with some kind of, democracy is not the word, some other system? Do we need to reinvent something? How do you see it sort of, to use the term, playing out?
Yeah. Well, I think there is, I perceive a disconnect, an increasing disconnect between political actors and ordinary citizens. It's absolutely clear in the anti-immigration protests. There have been hundreds in Ireland. In the United Kingdom, there have been many anti-immigration protests, many of which are peaceful across the country. And the rhetoric of politicians is consistently that the far right is pushing anti-immigrant sentiment. And,
that's an interesting one. Far right. Can I just stop you there? That's another term. I mean, we could bundle it in with the other words, hate speech and all that. It's become like that. And maybe even the word, racist. These are kind of weaponized. Is that the right word to use? Terms, words now that mean something different than they used to mean. They've kind of been appropriated for this sort of use.
Yes, it's another example. The far right, I mean, far right clearly has come to mean basically opinions that the political establishment don't like. Any opinion they don't like that pushes against, let's say, leftist and centrist politics, they will call far right. I think what you're seeing is a standoff between the political establishment and a lot of local communities. That kind of standoff is probably not going to end well because the political establishment is not likely to, let's say, give up easily in its agenda, in its policy commitments, and in its commitment to technocracy, right, to rule by an expert, so-called expert elite. So I would say that the more the technocrats dig in, the more they try to push their policies over the heads of the people, the more they will provoke a reaction in the people, a resentment, bitterness, anger. And so you're going to see probably more social unrest going forward. So if I were to kind of make a tentative prediction, which of course in politics it's very dangerous to make predictions, very difficult to know what's going to happen. But given what I've seen so far, I would say we're likely to see the technocratic political elite dig in even further, and then we're likely to see a kind of backlash in the public. We're likely to see more mobilization, more protests in the streets, and probably on the tail end of those protests, you're going to always have these violent elements that will come up and will emerge. And so you're going to see probably more burnings of migrant centers. You're probably going to see more, unrest and public disorder. And so the government will use its technocratic speech and its kind of, they'll say we have to clamp down on the uncivil discourse and on the incitement to hatred. But they're missing the point. See, the point is not that you just have a few rabble-rousers out there. The point is that the government has created an atmosphere in the United Kingdom and in Ireland and in France and in other countries, they're creating an atmosphere that is actually conducive, that is incendiary, and is conducive to public disorder. And so the more they clamp down with their anti-hate speech laws and rules and prosecutions, the more they will actually provoke a reaction in the public. So where will that kind of tension end in the end? Will it be that the governments will be removed from office because they'll just lose control of public order and it'll become so embarrassing that they'll have to call an election? Or will it be that we will just simply enter into a more despotic and tyrannical phase of modern democracy? I fear the latter. I do fear the latter. But as long as we have breath in us, I think citizens who understand what's going on should keep fighting against these tendencies and keep fighting against tyranny and against the abuse of power. Because the conclusion, the end, the outcome of this is not a foregone conclusion. We are free. We still have freedom. And that not just individually, but also corporate on a corporate level, collectively. And so I would say we should not give up. We should continue to fight. And the people who are fighting for free speech are much more passionate, in my experience, than a lot of the people who just go along with the hate speech nonsense.
Fascinating. Professor David Thunder, nice to have you back. Interesting to hear what you
nice
had to say.
Here.
And good luck in your part of the world. We all need
Thanks
it right
very
now.
Much.
But that was very well put at the end. I look forward to chatting again sometime.
Likewise.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.